Good evening. I'm Hank Jones. You are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here on Global Patriot Radio. You can be found pretty much every day at blogtalkradio.com. Welcome in Duck Northwest Media and Indie Hawk. Been a while. Indie Hawk is in the house as well in the chat room. It is Wednesday, August the 16th, 2023. It's the exact middle of August. Time is flying. Oh, my God, is it flying. So anyway, we're here pretty much most days. Mondays, 6 p.m. Eastern time, the Vito Esposito Show featuring Vito and Big Al, Mamma Mia, No Sharia. Wednesdays, it's me, Hank Jones, with Hank Jones Poly Sports. I occasionally do a Hankerings on Thursday. I've not done a couple. I said I was going to, but I've got so much going on right now. It's just tough for me to do, so I'll plan one in the next couple of weeks, especially with college football coming up. Saturday night's Minister Usama Dakduk and the Beautiful Christie revealing the truth about Islam. So we're looking for Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday for sure. And if we can get someone, I'll relinquish that day for anyone that needs to. Several ways we can interact. You can come into the chat room. You can listen online, but then you can also come into the chat room as well. For that one, you need to have an account to log in. Otherwise, you can just listen live. Click on the live button. Look for chatters down in the right-hand corner, and it'll tell you that we're up. It'll say Global Patriot Radio and how many people are actually in the chat room. You can also call in 319-527-6706. Listen into the show. You can also talk if you want. Hit the one on your phone, and I will get a little notification that says, hey, somebody wants to talk. Hanging out here in the Space Force Observation Outpost with my mini Aussie, who has consumed dinner and is laying quietly by my side. There's a little bit of a mini rain going on. She doesn't like that too much. She's better than she's been, but she's still not crazy about it. You can also interact via email anytime, hjpsports1980@gmail.com. Head over to Facebook and just type in Hank Jones Poly Sports, P-O-L-I Sports. Or head to Twitter, at H Poly Sports. A lot of good stuff going on there, as you can imagine, with the indictment stuff going on and whatnot. So let's get to today's first Internet Laffy. Got a couple callers listening in, as a matter of fact. Hawkeye Mike's listening in, Big Sister's listening in. Duck and Indy in the chat. So yeah, let's get to the first Internet Laffy. I'm not sure it's just a news story. Senator Dianne Feinstein is suing her late husband's estate. Now, where's the Laffy? Well, you can bet she doesn't even know what's happening. I mean, she's literally worth more doing nothing, apparently. And let's not forget one of last week's Laffy, which Babylon Bee reported in their usual style, the DNC has hired a professional puppeteer to operate the senator. The second one's good. Kim Jong-un attends Ivy League University to learn new brainwashing techniques. That's good. You have to see the pictures that go with some of these, and that's one of them, because he's sitting there in class, like, looking really intent. Let's get to last week's losses. A week ago, we lost iconic guitarist and songwriter Robbie Robertson to prostate cancer at age 80. He was the lead guitarist for the band. He also wrote most of their songs. He also wrote the score and the original music for The Color of Money. That was the 1986 film that finally gave Paul Newman a Best Actor Oscar. The most famous song is obviously The Wait. Take a load off, Annie. I'll feature a couple of his songs next week, along with a couple from Prince, from my Great Guitarists Who Are No Longer Here series. Last Thursday, we lost American cinematographer and producer Stan Waterman at the age of 100. His two biggest films worked on The Deep. And then before that, a pre-Jaws documentary about sharks called Blue Water, White Death. I started to watch that. Shark films kind of freak me out, not because I go in the water or anything like that. I've been freaked out ever since the movie Jaws. I just always... Last Friday, we lost American restaurateur Mike Young to pancreatic cancer at age 74. If you've never heard of him, he was only the founder of one of my go-to Mexican restaurants, Chuy's. We also lost American lyric writer Tom Jones to cancer at age 95. Now, people were confused, so to set it straight, no, not that Tom Jones, and thank God not brother Tommy, who's only 58. This was the Tom Jones who wrote Broadway lyrics for productions like The Fantastics, 110 in the Shade.
Yeah.
Last Saturday, former Iowa Hawkeye tight end Jameer Outsy was shot and killed in Elizabeth, New Jersey. He was just 27. Actually, an enduring memory I have isn't of him making a catch or anything like that. It's him running to celebrate the go-ahead touchdown with Riley McCarron after C.J. Beathard hit McCarron with a bullet in the end zone to take the lead against Iowa State in 2015. That game, in my opinion, is what launched that team to its 12-0 regular season, by the way. The incident is under investigation per authorities. Very sad. 27. I mean, that's just too young. Sunday, we lost rapper Magoo of Timbaland and Magoo, who also wrote Up Jumps Da Boogie. We also lost former NFL running back Alex Collins to a traffic accident at the age of 28. He spent part of the spring with the Memphis Showboats of the USFL before he was injured, and then this unfortunate accident. Monday, we lost former NHL hockey player Bobby Bonn at age 86. I didn't realize he was that old, and then I saw that he actually played for the Oakland Seals, which later became the California Golden Seals. When I saw that he played for the Oakland Seals, it was like, yeah, he'd been around. Yesterday, we lost former NFL wide receiver Gary Barnes to Parkinson's disease at age 83. His career was spent with several teams, including an NFL title with the Packers in 1962 season. So that's our significant losses for this week, I guess you'd say, the ones I deem significant. Not everybody does. I mean, to make my list, well, by gosh. You know. So, yeah, it's kind of sad. Don't forget my friends at Alliance Communications, Central Florida's premier 24-hour call center and answering service for your medical office, clinic, hospital clinic, survey gathering services, service companies, large and small. If you're one of those companies that's never going back to the office after COVID, they do a great job. They can front your calls for you, or they can just work as a sort of a relay. If you're into remote work, give them a call also. They work with remote staff, which is a considerable advantage in certain areas where they don't have to worry about things like hurricanes or snowstorms or whatever. Give them a call, 800-555-3738, or visit them on the internet at alliancecommunications.com. So President Trump is holding a news conference next Monday, at which time he will release a ton of information that he says will exonerate him in the latest Georgia indictment, as well as his co-defendants. American Action News has a short version of the story. It's kind of interesting what they say. So basically, he says it's an irrefutable report at a press conference, Bedminster, New Jersey. It's described as large, complex, detailed, but irrefutable. It will focus on alleged 2020 presidential election fraud in Georgia. And he says that the findings will lead to complete exoneration of himself and others. So he and 18 co-defendants were charged Monday night. The indictment says efforts to conspire to overturn Georgia's 2020 election results, where President Biden won by a narrow margin. Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis is centering the indictment on violations of the RICO Act, alongside charges related to false statements about the election. He says that all charges will be dropped. He says he's frustrated at the focus of those fighting to find the alleged riggers rather than those accused of actually rigging it. And his expectation is the report will serve as solid evidence that will lead to complete exoneration. Now, on that note, there's also this from Georgia. Georgia court admits flub. We released Trump document on web. Gee. So the Fulton County, Georgia County Clerk on Tuesday acknowledged the release on its website of a document about former President Trump being criminally charged, as Reuters reported, after they saw the document on the website. Statement from the court clerk said the system was being tested before the grand jury voted later in the day on whether to indict President Trump on charges of trying to overturn his election defeat. The court released a statement on Monday saying a media outlet had obtained a fictitious document. Tuesday's statement said, while it may have appeared that something official had occurred because the document bore a case number and filing date, include a signed true or no bill, nor an official stamp with Clerk Alexander's name, thereby making the document unofficial and a test sample only. In its statement, the court said a media outlet utilizing the Fulton County Press, Q, obtained a docket sheet on Monday. The document obtained by Reuters was publicly available on the website the court uses to disseminate public records. Team Trump was quick to slam the premature release, saying it exposed a disregard for the legal process. Attorneys Drew Findling and Jennifer Little said the Fulton County District Attorney's Office has once again shown that they have no respect for the integrity of the grand jury process. The 13 felony charges that the grand jury brought late on Monday against Trump matched those listed on the document that was posted on the court website earlier in the day and reported by Reuters. Yeah, the Georgia grand jury used a law developed basically to take down mobsters for trying to overturn his 2020 election fraud defeat. I'll tell you what, Hawkeye Mike nailed it the other night. Yeah, we text all the time, of course, and he absolutely nailed it. As he said, basically... Well, okay, let me give some. Okay, so basically he said, these indictments are infuriating. Democratic prosecutors in heavily Democratic counties top heavy with Democratic jury members indicting the president of another party. In these jurisdictions, Trump has as much of a chance at a fair trial as a young black man accused of rape being tried by an all-white Alabama jury in 1920. What sucks, supposedly, the charges are being brought by the state, thus a president can't pardon him. And that was T. Bodie and Indy Hawk pointed out, and it's timed with any and all news about Hunter Biden. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. It really is. I don't get it. Why the obsession? Did point out, the state convictions can be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. So, yeah, there's that. There is that. But, yeah, I have a laughy that'll address it a little bit later. An interesting news item on gun rights vis-a-vis marijuana use and or possession. American Liberty News reported the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals said that possession or use of an intoxicant does not by default remove gun rights. And basically what had happened, a gentleman had been convicted in a federal court for possessing a firearm while being an unlawful user of marijuana. Because of that, he was forever banned from possessing firearms, which is a fundamental right protected by the Second Amendment. Yesterday, the Fifth Circuit held that the ban was unconstitutional, at least as it applied to the gentleman that was convicted, Patrick Daniels. And it says, this is Judge Jerry Smith in the court's opinion, in short, our history and tradition may support some limit on an intoxicated person's right to carry a weapon. It does not justify disarming a sober citizen based exclusively on his past drug usage, nor do more generalized traditions of disarming dangerous persons support this restriction on nonviolent drug users. as applied to Mr. Daniels then, violates the Second Amendment. We reverse the judgment of conviction and render a dismissal of the indictment. I'll tell you why that's important. Basically, it's confirming that mere drug use or possession does not disqualify. Now, look, violent crime, whatever, yeah. But as they said in the, one of his attorneys said, and he said, we are pleased by the court's decision. As we explained in our brief, there is no tradition of disarming Americans based solely on their use of an intoxicant. And the government failed to prove that marijuana users are especially dangerous. Therefore, as the court held, consistent with America's tradition of firearm regulation and thus unconstitutional. Several of the firearms, FPC and FPCAF. So it's the Firearms Policy Coalition and their Action Foundation. And they said they will continue to seek the restoration of natural, fundamental, and enumerated rights for all people through its leading scholarly and litigation work. It later becomes a bit of a solicitation, but bottom line is this. You're not danger to anyone necessarily. And when they further try to decriminalize drugs, but then use that as a de facto disqualifier of a Second Amendment right, it's the ultimate hypocrisy. I mean, you either have the right to bear arms or you don't. To qualify it with all this garbage of assault weapons and rifles that are meant for this or that, I mean, no. The Second Amendment doesn't do that. It doesn't say that. It doesn't qualify that. It doesn't, in short, diminish or otherwise eliminate your rights under the Second Amendment. I mean, a DUI doesn't. Drug possession itself doesn't automatically indicate danger. So, yeah, it's sad that in 2023 we're still having to go through this. We're having to argue these kinds of things. But you know what? We're going to have to keep fighting this because they're not going to stop. So Senator Ted Cruz thinks Dopey Joe should be prosecuted and sent to prison. That's from the Patriot Journal. I mean, this is their telling of it. So I'll explain my semi-snark in a second. It says, Ted Cruz drops the hammer on President Biden. He just announced a punishment harsher than impeachment. Democrats are pulling out all the stops to prevent Donald Trump from returning to the White House. They have indicted him three times. Reports say Democrats out of Georgia will indict him again. Not because the evidence is overwhelming, but because the left won't survive if he returns to office. Meanwhile, we have heard a mountain of reports, testimony, documents, and more that implicate Joe Biden and his son. What has been piling up over the months is certain grounds for Republicans to launch an impeachment probe. If Kevin McCarthy has brains at all, he'd set up an impeachment vote ASAP. But one Republican senator says that is hardly enough to deal with crooked Joe Biden. And the Texas lawmaker is dropping the hammer on Biden. From the Western Journal, did they pay $10 million for Biden to do so? Oh, sorry. This is choppy. Sorry, it's just choppy. They're got to be better at this. Says, okay, I got to say. So if so, Joe Biden is guilty of bribery. Hunter is guilty of selling bribes, selling official favors from his father. And if that is the case, Joe Biden should be impeached. He also should be removed from office, and he should also be prosecuted, and he should go to prison.
Ooh.
Yeah, welcome to the party, Ted. Alas, you know, this guy is on social media soliciting donations to impeach. Go on Facebook. Ted Cruz is actually doing these posts soliciting donations to help impeach. Why do you need donations to do the job for which you were elected multiple times, in fact? Number one, you wouldn't bring impeachment. That would be the House. So why are you soliciting donations? I don't get it. And Ted Cruz is not the only one doing this type of scam. These people were elected to office. Office has certain duties and responsibilities. People donated money to get you elected. That's where it ends. No more money needed. Just do your job. That includes you, Speaker McCarthy. You were elected to do a job. You weren't elected to posture and preen on social media. You were elected to do the job of a congressman. You were then elected to lead the Republican-controlled House. That entails leadership responsibilities. So just do them. We don't care what you post on Twitter about all your disbelief and indignation. Look, it's bad enough. It's bad enough that some of you haven't done much to step up for President Trump, but you're definitely doing infinitely worse by not holding Dopey Joe to any semblance of accountability. Stop with the committee hearings. You have the evidence. Do your jobs. Quit with the preening. Quit with the posturing. We see through it. Do your damn job. Stop raising money for what you ostensibly have a budget in place for. The latest on Sam Bankman-Fried. He was released. Charges were dropped, and then, of course, they had to walk that back. So he was arrested again for witness tampering. And now federal prosecutors are saying that he allegedly used $100 million in funds that he stole via FTX to make political campaign contributions ahead of the 2022 elections. He also directed two FTX executives to avoid political contribution limits and conceal where the money was coming from. Reports from The Hill, prosecutors allege that he embezzled customer deposits, among other things, to help fund over $100 million in campaign contributions to Democrats and Republicans to seek to influence cryptocurrency regulation. In other words, they're doing this because it also included Republicans. They wouldn't be doing this otherwise. I'm sure of that. This is eerily similar, by the way, to the Hunter Biden plea deal. Prosecutors let him skate, only to be forced to retract and do their jobs. But even then, there's a catch. It's like, well, yeah, if we can catch a Republican in it, then what the hell? There's a phrase that the feds who went after the mob years ago used to use, and it sums up Big Left: money laundering. In this version, Big Left just launders it in both directions. I mean, they launder it through campaign contributions. They launder it through grift and theft. Speaking of Hunter, his attorney evidently is asked to withdraw from the case. What's his name? Jeff Clark. No, not Jeff Clark. There's a guy in Orlando I know named Jeff Clark. The hell? Whatever. His name's Clark. He filed a request to withdraw from representing him, citing potential conflicts arising from the possibility of being summoned as a witness in future litigation. We deal with centered around Hunter's admission to misdemeanor tax charges and participation in a pretrial diversion scheme. The move would have shielded him from a felony gun possession charge and granted him immunity against several future charges. Details of the plea agreement indicate that Biden would have acknowledged not remitting taxes on an income of $1.5 million for years 2017 and 18. In addition, he would have entered a deferred prosecution deal for the illicit possession of a firearm while intoxicated, a charge that carries a felony designation. However, this agreement encountered a roadblock in court. U.S. District Judge Mary Ellen Norelka questioned the inclusiveness of the immunity provision, labeling it as unparalleled. As a consequence, Clark's role could transform him from an advocate to a witness. In defense of his initial agreement, Clark recently submitted a motion insisting that the offer concerning the pre-trial diversion should be regarded as valid and binding. Complexities stemming from this situation underscore the intricate nature of the case and its subsequent developments. Question. What's so intricate about this, all of this? Hunter Biden used his father's influence to enrich their family and illegally strengthen their political control and enrich them financially. Again, what the hell is so intricate about that? What is so complex or difficult about all this? They are extortionists, thieves, corrupt influence peddlers, self-serving, self-enriching scumbags. What the hell is so hard about prosecuting them for that? Worse, what the hell is with making these plea deals? How many plea deals has President Trump been offered, by the way? Anybody know? Has President Trump been offered plea deals? Anybody? Anybody? Bueller? Has President Trump been offered any plea deals or any pretrial diversion? He wouldn't take it, of course, but I mean, the point is they're not even, that's not the point of their indictments. The point of their indictments is to go after a political opponent. Remember how they went, remember during the debate, one of the debates with Hillary Rodham Clinton? He made the comment that she'd be in jail. If he were president and they're going through all this, she'd be in jail. He wasn't saying he was going to put her in jail. That's not what he said, be in jail for what she did if he were president. In other words, he wouldn't have let her off. He wouldn't have just let it skate. He wouldn't have rigged an investigation to protect her. She'd be in jail. Of course, it was taken out of context that he's going to go after her. He's going to try and prosecute her and put her in jail. That's what all the sheep said. All the never Trumpers, the basic sheep, big left, whatever, all factions. That's what they said. They're going after him on the most meager grounds on a daily basis now. And yet it seems impossible. With all we've seen and heard, all we've read, all that's come out, it seems impossible to prosecute Hunter Biden. It seems impossible to, I mean, what's so hard about impeachment? It's not, I mean, for those that say, first of all, there are Republicans that say, it's going to be a mistake, or whether it's McConnell or McCarthy or whoever, oh, it's going to be a mistake. Shut up. The Democrats knew indicting Trump or impeaching Trump was going nowhere. In spite of people like Liz Cheney, speaking of which, she has said it is her mission. She's making it her mission to make sure he doesn't get into office. But that's not election interference. I mean, the hypocrisy is astounding, of course, but what the hell is so hard about prosecuting Hunter and Joe Biden? Then again, when you see that a Sam Bankman freed is released and has charges dropped, and they have to walk it back, of course. Here's an interesting piece from the New York Post on the recent denial of a Department of Justice appeal on the La Dopi Nostra censorship campaign. So, okay, Biden censors battered, and they expect it, they say it's going to get all the way to the Supreme Court, which, you know, yeah. That's their MO. Legislate, litigate. Federal judges hammered fresh nails into the coffin of the Biden censorship regime last Thursday in New Orleans. The thrashing the administration received will likely set up an epic Supreme Court battle that could help redefine freedom of our era. A federal appeals court was hearing the Justice Department's appeal of a July 4th decision in Missouri versus Biden that ignited pro-freedom rhetorical fireworks across the nation. God, some of these people. Federal Judge Terry Doughty damned the Biden administration for potentially launching the most massive attack against free speech in United States history. He delivered 155 pages of damning details of federal browbeating, jawboning, and coercion of social media companies. He issued an injunction, blocked the feds from encouraging, pressuring, or inducing in any manner the removal, deletion, suppression, or reduction of content containing protected free speech. The Biden administration, a.k.a. La Dopey Nostra, rushed to sway the appeals court to postpone enforcement of the injunction and then sought to redefine all its closed-door shenanigans as public service. In its brief, the DOJ declared there is a categorical, well-settled distinction between persuasion and coercion and castigated Judge Doughty for having, quote, equated legitimate efforts of persuasion with illicit efforts to coerce. The department denies that federal agencies bullied social media companies to suppress any information. Instead, there were simply requests for, quote, content moderation, unquote, especially regarding COVID. Actually, there were tens of thousands of requests that resulted in the suppressions of millions of posts and comments by Americans. Apparently champions a no corpse, no delicta definition of censorship. Since federal SWAT teams did not assail the headquarters of social media firms, the feds are blameless. Or as Justice Department lawyer Daniel Tenney told judges, there was a back and forth. Sometimes it was more friendly, sometimes people got more testy. There were circumstances in which everyone saw eye to eye. There were circumstances in which they disagreed. It's irrelevant that President Joe Biden publicly accused social media companies of murder for not censoring far more material, and that Biden appointees publicly threatened to destroy the companies via legislation or prosecution. Nope, it was just neighborly discussions between good folks. At the hearing, Judge Don Willett, one of the most principled and penetrating judges in the nation, again, the hyperbole, had no problem with federal agencies publicly criticizing what they judged false or dangerous ideas. That wasn't how Team Biden compelled submission. Here you have government in secret, in private, out of the public eye, relying on subtle strong-arming and veiled or not-so-veiled threat. Willett vivified how the feds played the game. That's a really nice social media platform you've got there. It would be a shame if something happened to it. Judge Jennifer Elrod compared the Biden censorship regime to the mafia. We see the mob. They have these ongoing relationships. They never actually say, go do this or else you're going to have this consequence, but everybody just knows. She doesn't know much about the mob, does she? Yet La Dopey Nostra was supposedly innocent because the feds never explicitly spelled out or else, according to the Justice Department lawyer. This is on par with redefining armed robbery as a consensual activity, unless the robber specifically points his gun at the victim's head. As economist Joseph Schumpeter aptly observed, power wins not by being used, but by being there. On top of censorship, the feds used deceit to taint the 2020 presidential election. As Dean John Sauer, the state of Missouri's lawyer, explained, the FBI engaged in deception by prepping social media platforms to expect false reports on Hunter Biden and then failing to admit the FBI had verified his laptop as authentic. That spurred pervasive suppression of the New York Post expose in October 2020. It was a prime example of federal meddling that Judge Doughty invoked to justify leashing the FBI and other agencies. Because Dopey Joe ended the COVID hoax in May, I shouldn't say hoax, COVID pandemic in May, the Justice Department pretends this case's issues are moot. But the La Dopey Nostra also pressured social media companies, quote, to censor misinformation regarding climate change, gender discussions, abortion, and economic policy, as the July 4th court decision noted. There is no reason to expect La Dopey Nostra and federal censorship contractors will not seek to taint another presidential election next year. At least two of the three judges on last week's panel will likely uphold all or part of the injunction against federal censorship. La Dopey Nostra will probably speedily appeal the case to the Supreme Court, setting up an epic showdown. If La Dopey Nostra can destroy freedom of speech by renaming censorship content moderation, what other freedoms will it destroy with rhetorical scams? If endless demands by the FBI and other agencies don't amount to quote-unquote coercion, then it is folly to expect the feds to ever admit how they are decimating Americans' rights and liberties. Here's the thing, though. This wasn't the La Dopey Nostra browbeating or coercing social media companies. That's the mistaken part of it. This is La Dopey Nostra and social media companies colluding against anyone and everyone who doesn't support their tyranny, their oppression, their lust for complete and utter power. I don't get why news outlets, especially those who are postured as conservative, tiptoe around this. It's pretty clear. La Dopey Nostra and big media, including social media, and coordinated this garbage. It wasn't La Dopey Nostra or Big Left twisting each other's arms. It wasn't. It was the various groups, man. It was hand in glove, arm in arm, lockstep. This posturing that it was, oh, they forced them. Bullshit! You're going to tell me Mark Zuckerberg felt pressured? You're going to tell me Jack Dorsey felt pressured? Holy Christ, what do they expect us to believe next? They're actually making it sound as if big media and social media was victimized by a corrupt FBI, by a corrupt Department of Justice, by a corrupt group, not small, by the way, of folks in our federal government. That's what I don't get. I mean, I get the upholding the decision. I get some of their castigation, but to turn it into the government pressured it, good Lord, no. Don't buy that. There was no pressure. These were people working hand in glove. These were people coordinating this. When they say there were arguments and sometimes disagreements, I tell you what, that was only on the extent of the suppression. It was probably an individual here or there who tried to step in and say this is wrong. But to expect us to believe that, oh boy, this was real government pressure. There was no pressure. Stop it. There was no pressure to do this. These people work together to do this. I mean, this is going to sound crazy, like I'm wearing a tinfoil hat. I promise you I am not. I think, personally, I think the only thing they have debated over the campaign and over the objections and the claims of fraud and the indictments, I think the only thing they're debating is whether or not they could get away with assassinating President Trump. I literally believe there is a sizable portion of big left that would say, yeah, I think we could. Or at worst, should we try? Is it worth exploring? Assassination a little later. There is a segment of big left. Make no mistake, and I shouldn't make it like they're singling out. I mean, they would assassinate you or I if they thought we were in the way. Again, though, President Trump is very high profile, and he's not without his own means of finding this kind of thing out, and he's not without his own means of detailing it. So if it were to happen, stuff would come out, most likely. Think for a second that these people are just doing their job and just trying to do what's right for the country. That ship sailed within our federal government years ago. That ship has sailed. I mean, to even say that it's, you know, it was Obama or even Clinton or Biden. No, that ship sailed a long while ago. I mean, you can fault the military-industrial complex. You can fault this alphabet agency or that alphabet agency. But the idea that they're doing what's best for the country and to serve the country, let's stop that. I mean, yes, we still elect congresspersons, senators and congresspersons and other elected officials. We still elect them on the premise that they will serve the country. But make no mistake, there is a huge portion of them that have no intention of ever doing that. Another person entering the chat room, Joseph Gibson. Good to see you, sir. He has his own show here on Blog Talk Radio, and he is also, I believe, a candidate for State House in the state of North Carolina, where someday I may end up moving when if our daughter decides, when our daughter and her husband decide to start a family, they have said they would probably move back east, probably the Carolinas. So rather than try to be grandparents from Florida, we would pull up stakes. Wouldn't be guiding on the Space Coast, but I'd figure something out. Okay, let's move on. In the quasi-poly sports vein, the Mason City, Iowa school district has gone slightly overboard. The district has pulled from the shelves the rather popular book, which was also made into a movie and later a TV series, called Friday Night Lights. The book is actually called Friday Night Lights, A Town, A Team, and a Dream. Seriously. First, it's a great book. It tells the story of Permian High School in Odessa, Texas. That state, if you don't know, takes its high school football as be-all, end-all, pretty much. They tailgate before games. Literally, they tailgate before games. They have thousands of people in the stands. Players transfer onto better teams and programs. Star players, of course, are idolized as well as sought after the moment they show any potential to excel at the next level. Now, in the case of Friday Night Lights, the book details the various player profiles, the team's disappointing regular season, the coach. Its playoff berth that year came as a result of a coin toss between three teams tied for the last two spots. Permian was one of those teams that won in the coin toss. They then went on to advance to the state semifinals before they lost to the rather high-powered and heavily favored team from Dallas Carter, which featured former Miami Hurricane and NFLer Jesse Arnstead. That team later had its championship revoked. Turned out a lot of those guys were not going to class, having grades fixed, etc. Permian did go on to win the state championship the following season, which is related, by the way, in the book's prologue. It's a fantastic read, even if you're not a football fan. You literally couldn't find better material for a movie. It has literally, the self-doubting quarterback, the star player who gets injured after building himself into a NFL all-pro mindset, the smart jock linebacker, the undersized offensive and defensive linemen who yet, you know, in spite of their lack of size, excel on the field, the coach under pressure, who in this case, his job is saved by an improbable flip of a coin. Now, the movie took a little bit of artistic license, but it is equally enjoyable. So why then is it being removed from high school bookshelves? This is real life. It's not made-up drama with caricature and stereotype. Yes, the book features use of the N-word. But it's not like it was inserted for dramatic effect or intentional degradation. The N-word is used as often in the book by black players as it is by white players and coaches. The irony here is given the Big Left's subsistence on double standards, part of their core, some of the libs are saying, keep Governor Kim Reynolds out of our schools. What? You most likely know Governor Reynolds is a somewhat conservative Republican who also, by the way, fought the attempted COVIDization of that state during one of the darkest periods in our nation's history. Yeah, I think I get it now. I guess I do get it. Yeah. There are actually people who are saying, keep government. She's not the Mason City School District. And trust me, Mason City ain't the most conservative part of that state. Books on Adam and Steve and Kiss My Husband's Beard or whatever, that shit's fine. That's good. We're good with that. We're good with drag shows for kindergarten kids. But a perfectly acceptable, very well-written book that tells a very good story about a real-life situation. Oh, also, they also use the usual add-ons of there's drinking and some womanizing. Yeah. Yeah, you guys care about that. Unbelievable. It's what we're coming to, folks, but it's unbelievable. It really is. Tucker Carlson did an interview with RFK Jr. In my opinion, it confirms what I keep trying to tell people about RFK Jr. So American Briefing is reporting this. RFK says, I talked to the CIA hitmen who killed JFK. In a bombshell interview with Tucker Carlson, RFK Jr. delved deep into the alleged CIA involvement in the assassination of his uncle, John F. Kennedy. This comes months after Carlson's bold reporting on both the JFK assassination and the Watergate scandal, actions believed by many to have led to his controversial departure from the once dominant Fox News. RFK Jr. pointed out the connections between the people linked to JFK's assassination and the Miami station. He said to Carlson, almost all the people associated with JFK's assassination were involved with the Miami station, which was the largest CIA station at the time and was basically the Cuban station. The people who were involved were people like Bill Harvey and David Attlee Phillips, who were clearly involved in my uncle's assassination. By all evidence, he was Lee Harvey Oswald's handler at the CIA. E. Howard Hunt made a confession. David Morales, who was the chief hitman, he ran the Operation Phoenix program in Vietnam. He killed 10,000 people. He also gave a confession of being in Dallas. The Cuba station was angry at my uncle for not sending in air cover during the Bay of Pigs invasion. After the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, my uncle developed this friendship with Khrushchev, and he shut down all the attacks on Cuba by Alpha 66 and other groups who were harassing Cuba and sinking Russian ships. Dude, you are so misguided. They were operating flotillas out of South Florida and doing raids. My uncle and father sent the Coast Guard to confiscate their ships and weaponry and arrest those that kept doing it. Yeah, they were blackmailed. RFK Jr. also detailed his conversations with hitmen involved in the shooting of his uncle. Sylvestriana met Oswald in Dallas in September 1963. I've talked to the people who are working for the CIA and the mob at that time to kill Castro, and some of them were pivoted to this new project. Tucker questioned why Biden hadn't declassified the JFK assassination documents, and RFK raised the same point about Trump, of course. Tucker mentioned that Trump was advised against it by Mike Pompeo. RFK pointed out that the JFK assassination law mandated the release of all related documents by 2017, but around 4,000 documents remain classified. Tucker speculated that this might hint at significant hidden information, with RFK Jr. suggesting the withheld documents may be more about safeguarding institutional interests than individuals. Like I said, it confirms two things I keep trying to tell people who say RFK Jr. would make a great VP for Trump or that he's not part of Big Left or whatever. He's a crackpot. Info was taken from the script for the movie JFK. As I have said before, great movie making, but short on truth and accuracy. He's literally regurgitating crap that's already public knowledge. And number two, he's still a Kennedy. And as a member of that family, they sure are big on making statements, but rarely do they actually delve into the whole thing versus just regurgitating the usual stuff that comes out in media decades later. Seriously, if RFK Jr. really spoke with the hitmen, whether mob or CIA or whatever, there'd be no more RFK Jr. I'm not a mob insider, but I'm pretty sure most of the stuff I've read and seen, when a hitman tells you he killed someone and you're not in that circle, he's not telling you just as casual talk. Going to kill you anyway. This is weird, but JFK Jr. is the one who ended up having the last shred of credibility in that family. Seriously. He's the last one. Okay, as I said, maybe I didn't say, but it's a short show tonight, but before I call it a night with another summarization of the paddleboard saga, I have a question about the Maui wildfires. Now, I actually asked it on Twitter as well. In light of the fires, which, by the way, could be called Dopey Joe's Fiddle moment, I got to ask, where is that Hawaiian-born former president of ours, Barack Obama, and all this? You haven't heard barely a peep. We know that for at least a couple hours, he was not at his Martha Vineyards estate, as I'll relate later. So why are we hearing so little, if anything, at all from him on the wildfire that's killed as many as 100 people in his alleged home state. Or maybe it's as simple as this. It's not really his home state. That would be one explanation. Okay, I'm going to end tonight with final thoughts on the paddleboard saga, i.e. the death of former White House chef and former personal chef to the Obamas, Tafari Campbell. Here goes. We know for sure the following. Tafari Campbell died after entering Edgartown Pond on a paddleboard. Edgartown Pond is like part of the intercoastal waterway. It's not the ocean, but it's not really a pond. So it's a bay off the ocean. We know that a female asked Secret Service to call 911 to report Campbell was in distress, was missing, and couldn't be located by the female. Allegedly a female staffer. We know that Campbell was said to be found in 8 feet of water, 100 feet from shore. Now, we have been told in snippets that he experienced some sort of distress that left him off of his board. We have also been told that he wasn't wearing a personal flotation device. We were later told he was not leashed to his board. We were later told that after I started bringing it up on social media and on this show. Before that, it was never in the stories. That's why I asked it. We are also later told that the incident occurred around 7:25 p.m. and the 9/11 call was placed at 7:46 p.m. What have we not been told? We have still not been told if, when, or where the board itself was located. I haven't seen it anywhere. Now, if you've seen it, please correct me. Hit me up on social media, whatever. But we have not been told when or where the board itself was located. With all the details, oh, he wasn't wearing a PFD, he wasn't leashed. What about the board? Well, that would explain not being leashed, of course. But there is a tidal element to that body of water. Now, we've not been told the name of the staffer or the Secret Service agent who placed the call. Now, in the case of the Secret Service agent, that may be protocol, standard protocol. We have not been told where the Obamas actually were in terms of whether they were out of the house for a few hours or a few days or however long they were, quote, not at the house. Now, this is what I have surmised or what I question, given the various conversations I have had, the apparent protocols, the people I've talked to, things I've read. A Secret Service agent wouldn't be at the house with just a staffer and personal chef. If there's no family there, Secret Service wouldn't be there. Secret Service detail doesn't protect chefs. It doesn't protect staffers. They are not house watchers. The same type of thing. Watching a house for security isn't a Secret Service agent's job. They may consult with security people, but no, they don't sit and watch the house. It's not what they do. Now, I've brought this up. Told you what my boss had said. The staffer in question, could it actually be one of the Obama daughters or another family member? We keep hearing the Obamas were not at home. But does that mean all of them? Or does it just mean the former president? What about Big Mike? Great pains have been taken, usually as a follow-up, to stress that Campbell wasn't wearing a PFD and wasn't leashed. What about the female staffer? No mention of that. Why not? Certainly relevant. Why is it relevant? Because you know what? If the female staffer was leashed and wearing a PFD, that would seem to indicate that conditions warranted it, basic safety. Now, if the Secret Service was on site, do they not make sure anyone entering the water from the estate is safely equipped to go out on the water? Let's say, for instance, Campbell and the unnamed staffer were taking a boat belonging to the estate, whether they were piloting it or someone else. Wouldn't they verify and ensure the safety worthiness of the boat? as well as the operator of said boat, stands to reason they would do the same with a paddleboard or a canoe or a kayak or a surfboard or any other water-going vessel. I keep harking back to what my boss said when he said, I just assumed it was one of the Obama daughters. I can't believe I hadn't thought about that. That was further brought about by Vito and Al, noting the presence of the Secret Service, why the Obamas weren't apparently at home at the time of the incident. Look, I know I keep going on about my guide experience, and damn it, I believe I'm correct on this. We don't allow people on the water, personally, I mean, in our without a safety briefing. We make sure anyone who can't swim wears a PFD, and it's still up in the air as whether there's still conflicting reports about whether he could swim or not. We encourage others to wear it, even though we don't strictly mandate it. However, we do strictly mandate implementation of a paddleboard leash. It's open water. Wind will enter in at some point. It just does. Even when we experience no near total calm, as guides, we always keep an eye on wind, thunder, lightning. I mean, we monitor various apps. We monitor radar on our phones. Personally, I've utilized various weather apps. I use radar readings. I use lightning proximity readings. I utilize wind speed. I have apps for all that. I check it before I go out on a paddle. I check it at any breaks or rest stops that we take. I do it during the paddle itself. I'm going to assume that the Secret Service or any estate staff would do the same before anyone leaves the estate to head out on the water. Which brings me to my last question and or observation. Why has nothing been said about the weather conditions noted about them? I haven't read that. Possibility of some rough water. And if the water was that rough, why would Secret Service or other staff, why would they allow them on the water without PFDs or implementing leashes? In short, okay. And again, people are thinking I'm weird or whatever. I have a fellow guide who works for one of our local our local paper, which is affiliated with the Chicago Tribune, Sierra Orlando Sentinel. It's a friend of mine. He's a good guide. I'm not going to, you know. But you can guess his political affiliation, I'm pretty sure. He says, oh, it's not a conspiracy. I'm not saying it's a conspiracy. I'm saying it's a cover-up. It doesn't add up, and I don't know that it ever will unless people question it. Now, I could go viral or whatever, and I could raise all of this ad nauseum. But as I said, I have a job I love. And while I don't mind pushing it a little, I have my bosses and their company to consider. You know, I do have that to consider. We sort of know what can happen to people and companies who go against the narrative. And it's not my right to endanger the company or the owners, or especially the livelihoods of my fellow guides, on some crusade that in the end, nobody really, beyond me and a few others, actually care about knowing. I mean, I care to know just for the detail. I don't care about, I didn't know Defari Campbell. I don't care about the Obamas. But like I said, one of my fellow guides works for a local paper. He sees nothing odd in all that, but given his affiliation, I'm not surprised. He wasn't even old enough to vote for Obama in 2008 or 2012. He is, I'm sure, somewhat liberal. So I don't really wonder why he doesn't question it. He's a great guy. He's a good friend. He's a fantastic guide. Anything I do that could make waves, for the company would include him. So I just can't go that far. But I would encourage people to monitor this, question the narrative, and for God's sake, would somebody please clarify whether or not Defari Campbell could actually swim? That alone is sketchy enough. Okay, one other item. Several folks that I mutually follow on Twitter posted a heartbreaking video of a small young trying to share cookies with her new neighbors who happened to be black kids that were appreciably older than her. It's heartbreaking because it's pretty obvious in the video that this girl didn't understand or comprehend the concept of racism. But the kids hit her. One guy was saying, why are you hitting yourself? And they were grabbing her hand and hitting her. They threw her cookie on the ground. They attacked her again when she tried to pick it up. She's bawling. It's terrible. I can't. I've watched it a couple times, and it's heartbreaking. It's unclear to me, at least to me, who was filming it, but it's pretty clear that the person was instigating the whole thing. Whoever's filming it, included instruction on how and where to hit the poor little girl. Now, I'm sure nothing will come of this, being that it's probably a protected group of people in that little enclave. But know this. This is my reaction. If I ever see anything like this, regardless of skin color of those involved, I will go to any lengths to see people held accountable. No, I'm not threatening. No, I would not get violent. But I will film you. I will call police, and I will follow up to see that you are made to look like the pieces of trash that you obviously are. I hope to hell that the filmer or instigator isn't a parent of one or all of the attackers, speculated that it was. If that is the case, I retract what I said about violence, because it's damn near unforgivable. And whoever raised these kids needs to cease being a parent and have their parental rights terminated. This is absolutely heartbreaking. I don't even know how to address it from the standpoint of, I mean, it's just beyond sickening. A couple good final internet laughy from Babylon B. These are good. Trump indicted for removing mattress tag in 1997. That's a good one. Trump indicted for Maui wildfire. This was good. Disaster relief plane flies over Hawaii on way to Ukraine. Pretty sick, actually. Another one. This is good. It's a photo of Karine Jean-Pierre, press secretary. It says, White House assures nation we're not a banana republic, but we're a democratic banana republic. That's good. That is good. Then finally, greatness as usual from the Babylon Bee with this, particularly for the ladies. The 8 subtle signs you might be playing against a trans athlete. And again, the picture that accompanies it shows this huge guy running against this poor girl. It says, ladies, have you ever been ready for a game to start when you looked over at your opponent and thought, hold up, is that a dude? To help you figure it out, we at the Babylon Bee have put together 8 subtle signs that you might be playing against a trans athlete. Number 1. On their jersey, the name Steve is crossed out and Jessica is written over it. Seems a bit suspect. 2, when they get hit in the groin, they yell, ow, my balls! Not a sure sign, but something to look out for. 3, they have asked to have a urinal installed in the ladies' room. Awfully suspicious. Number 4, you just got scratched by their beard while driving to the hoop. Don't want to rush to judgment here, but that just might be a guy. Number 5, they were ranked in the 400s last season, but suddenly are the number 1 athlete in the state. Yeah, suspect. Number 6, they break 3 of your fingers during the post-game handshake, plus your team just lost 514-6. 7, Adam's apple keeps poking you in the eye when you're trying to guard him. The price you have to pay for equality. And number 8, they can actually make penalty shots. That's a dead giveaway right there, folks. Jab it. Megan, Mr. Rapino. So that's it for tonight, folks. I am going to get into college football more next week, and I am going to, in the next week or two, not tomorrow, but in maybe next week or the week after, I am going to delve into some hankerings on Thursday. Might even, you know, who knows? We'll see what comes up. But in honor of the fact that college football is approaching, I will send you off with a song that used to get featured on, it was featured mainly on This Week in Baseball, but it was also featured during several different football telecasts back in the day. It's called Gathering Crowds. want to thank everyone for being here, Duck and Indy and Joseph Gibson. Check out Joseph's show. And thank Mike and my sister for listening on the phones. And, of course, a couple members I still don't recognize, but whatever. They don't ask to speak, so there's that. Mike asked me by text if that girl is all right. I don't know. I don't honestly know. I haven't seen. And so just no way of knowing. Could ask some of the people that posted it. You know, so that would be one way. So that's all I know. So in the meantime, folks, have a great rest of your week. Have a great weekend. Stay on top of things. Don't back down. Don't let people get away with not being accountable. Simple as that. Have a great one, folks. Good night.